and welcome to the Wine Access Unfiltered Podcast. It's season 3, episode 2, and also it's March Madness. And I know what you're thinking, Amanda. You are not the biggest basketball fan. And you're right. I am not the biggest basketball fan. But I felt like I couldn't pass up the opportunity to pit the world's best regions against each other in a competitive yet constructive fashion. And the real question is why? Why are we here to do that? Why would we take our time to pit France against Spain, against Italy? And as I mentioned at the beginning of season 3, this season is all about how to be a savvy wine buyer. And part of being a savvy wine buyer is knowing how to decipher and decide between regions when you're out in the wild shopping and selecting wine. Because we've all been there, right? We've all been in a shop or selecting online and we're like, I don't know, like which region should I head to first? That's kind of what this episode's all about. Why would you choose Washington wine over somewhere like Bordeaux? Does Champagne really make the best sparkling wine? Or are there situations in which perhaps Cava or even Prosecco might make more sense? And what I think is fun is that we've sort of done a lot of episodes dedicated to specific regions and styles of wine, but we've never actually done is taken a look at all of these regions sort of through this sort of macro lens, which is really where you get to put your skills to the test and think kind of like a psalm. So we gave you all the basics and now we're putting it to the test. We are sending you out once again into the wild with all the information and ammunition you need. And speaking of psalms, I can see these two sort of wincing. They're like, oh gosh, no more tests. We're done with tests. We've got two psalms with us today. You guys know them. You love them from the Wine Access team, Eduardo and Laura. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having us. This is quite exciting, and we couldn't say no to a fun March Madness wine edition.
That's right. And you guys were – so we're all participating in this sort of like March Madness wine edition thing on Instagram. So if you are following both Wine Access and or Wine Access and Filter on Instagram, we've all taken a region and are sort of championing that region through video and through a few different posts. And we're actually letting you guys vote on which region you think should come out on top. Laura, you've got France. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I have to kind of feel like I got the number one seed. I got France. I feel like it's mine to lose, but I am very open to everyone else's ideas and contributions. I drink from around the world, so I'm not exactly biased, but I mean.
Yeah, exactly.
And Eduardo, you think you got like a newcomer, right?
I got the U.S.
USA.
Go U.S. Yeah. Quite diverse and fun.
That's super fun. That's actually a hard one to like put together because we're doing these like little 30-second videos. It's hard to kind of summarize that in 30 seconds. And Eduardo, I know you are a global drinker as well. That I love when we first put up the regions and you were like, I'll take Japan. I'm like, not on the roster, buddy.
Of course.
You can do it.
Come on. Why is Japan not there? Japan should be represented.
Didn't even qualify. Didn't even make the qualifying round.
High on my list. And then Italy, of course. But U.S., I mean, we are in the U.S. and we have such outstanding areas and great producers. Yeah. So it's for you to vote, for all of us to enjoy.
Exactly, so. Exactly.
For the sports analogy, like the U.S. has some underdog regions, right?
Yes.
Like we've tasted, just this year I've had Arizona wine, Texas wine. Like actually my mom right now is in Georgia wine country.
Ooh.
With some friends.
Let's not go crazy.
Told her, she offered to sign me up for the wine club, but I told her we're pretty full on wine right now.
Oh.
Right now, I'm actually taking a break from judging. I'm at the LA International Wine Competition, which is the oldest in the U.S., and I just tasted a number of hybrids.
Ooh.
From all throughout, from Missouri to Kansas to, you name it, New Mexico, Utah. So every state makes wine in the United States, including Hawaii. We've been to that
We have been to Hawaii winery. So you're talking hybrid grapes, right? So not fully
all kinds.
Vinifera.
There's some vinifera and then some hybrids. But yeah, every state has to adapt. We tasted a wine from Florida, which I don't know why anybody would make wine in certain parts of Florida.
Yeah.
But they do. And they have this hybrid that adapts to the humidity and the way it's produced. And it's fascinating.
So hybrid grapes, for those wondering, you know, in the wine world, we always talk about Vitis vinifera, which is your Cabernet Sauvignon, your Sauvignon Blanc, your Cabernet Franc, Merlot. Those are all part of the Vitis vinifera family. And that's mostly what's been planted for years and years and years. But because grapes are trying to be grown in these other places, some of these varietals can't really survive in colder climates, more hot climates, mildew, heavy climates, or even places like Florida that don't have like real seasons. And so these hybrid varieties are effectively a variety between Vitis lambrusca and Vitis vinifera that they crossbreed to make them a little bit more compatible. So you're seeing a lot more of it. It used to be that nobody touched hybrids in like a real way. Like some were like, ugh, hybrid grapes. But you are seeing with, you know, with climate change, you're seeing a lot more winemakers take them seriously. And so when you see them out in the wild, you know, take a peek. They might be better than you expect.
Absolutely. Japan actually has a wide variety of hybrids. When I started judging and tasting a lot of wines in Japan, I was subjected to those. And yeah, they're interested. Let's leave it at that.
All roads lead back to Japan.
Oh, yep.
Oh man, I love it. Well, speaking of all roads leading back, we're going to be coming back to you in just a second with what's going on in the wine world and a super exciting story around that. All right, you guys, I'm sure you're both familiar with the winery Patson Hall, right?
Mm-hmm.
Classic California producer, Pinot Noir, Chardonnay. They were purchased, as you might remember, a few years ago by St. Michel Wine Estates. And Donald Patz departed, started his own thing. But James Hall actually stayed on for a little while and kind of, you know, was overseeing winemaking and working on this. In any case, something super exciting is happening because we all hear about wineries being purchased and kind of going off, you know, into the sunset. But in this case, James Hall is coming back to his roots
back,
and he
baby.
Bought back Patson Hall. How exciting is that?
That's amazing. Couldn't have happened to somebody that believes and has all that attention to detail and everything. And that's his baby.
Yeah.
It's just an amazing. I was talking to a few people today about it, and I'd say it's like a Disney story.
Yeah.
The perfect Disney story for the wine
totally.
World.
Totally. Yeah. And at 65 years old, you know, at a time when most people are thinking about retirement, and as he said, you know, you can only play so much golf, right? Interesting. St. Michel Wine Estates has been offloading a lot of their California wineries, and they famously just parted ways with Stag's Leap Wine Cellars to their partner Antinori. And so they've really been focusing on the Pacific Northwest, which we should definitely, like, I think see as maybe a marker of some sort. But mm-hmm. I love that James, you know, at 65 has decided that, like, he wants it back. It's his. He built it from the ground up. And here we are.
And I can say, having known him really actually over these last 8 years, like, he is... I can't, like, he never stepped away. Mm. You know, he was still winemaker emeritus. He was still really hands-on focused on everything that winery is. So besides maybe some names on the paper and like where this all goes, like, he has been in this 100% as, you know, as if it were his own for the past 10 years,
yeah.
You know, underneath them. So feels like the right continuation, but it was a shocking story because we just don't see that very often where the gets sold back to the
I can't think of any other time that it's happened. I'm sure there's maybe some time that it's happened before, but super exciting. You know, I don't know if that's a trend that we'll see more of, but I definitely wanted to spotlight that because I love Patson Hall. That was actually, I used to tell Donald Patz this when I worked in New York. One of the very first, like, expensive bottles of wine that I bought for myself was a bottle of Patson Hall Chardonnay. And I remember going around to the corner store and, like, I think it was like $30. And I was like, I don't know if I can afford this, but I did it.
And with the beautiful cartouche on the embossing on the bottle. It's just like such an iconic. Those wines are so good. I know probably all three of us have had one of their wines by the glass on one of our programs.
Yes, 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 iconic. And I'm very excited to see how they continue that brand because it's an iconic Napa brand, or iconic California brand, and one that I think should have legs. In other news, y'all remember Rudy Kiernewan?
Sure. Yeah.
I haven't heard about this. What's
happening? Is he here? Is he our fourth guest?
Okay. He's not here.
No.
But I'm not opposed to it. He may want to be back though, because he is trying to return to the spotlight and succeeding. So apparently, so for those of you who have no idea what we're talking about, Rudy Kiernewan, Kiernewan is leaning into his criminal celebrity. His lawyer, Jerry Mooney, is going on the record to confirm that Keir Nirwan, who is now 51, is being hired to create fake versions of 1990 DRC Romani Conti and 1990 Petrus. And just to back up, for those who are like, who the hell is this guy? If you've ever seen this like documentary, Sour Grapes, this guy for like years was fooling the entire wine industry by going to auctions, buying tons and tons of wine for crazy amounts of money, like outbidding like the Koch brothers, right? Like crazy amounts of dollars. But that's not what he got famous for. He got famous because he ended up faking all of these wines and duping all of these people because he would then sell these wines. And so, I mean, it was like millions and millions of dollars of fake wine that he ended up getting arrested and went to jail for like 10 years. This is a great story and I'm not telling it super well, so you should go watch the documentary. But he's back.
I would want to taste his approximation of a wine. I would want, I definitely would. I actually was talking to someone recently that is, you know, 99.9% sure they have one of Rudy's bottles and hasn't opened it. And it's, that in it of itself is kind of a collectible thing.
Oh,
because
good
Rudy's
point.
Become famous and his bottles have become famous. So like, I understand a lot of these people that ended up buying these bottles and don't want to admit that half their cellar's fake.
Yeah.
I do understand that. But if you have like one or two that you're like, I know that Rudy made this in his condo in LA, it's definitely maybe not as valuable as what the label should, like if it were real, but it is still really cool. And I'd be super curious.
Oh my God, that I've never thought about that point that until now, but that's, you're absolutely right. It is truly one of a kind. And like, say what you want about the guy. I mean, he went to jail. It was an impressive thing that he was pulling off because he was duping everybody. And apparently the wine's really pretty good that he was making. So I would be curious to try it.
Pretty damn close. Where people didn't pick it up. Yeah. Even seasoned collectors and even producers sometimes didn't.
And I would think that there's probably, you know, as these like people that'll come out and like get a bottle that's made by Rudy, authenticated that it's made by him.
Oh my gosh.
And we'll even see those in an auction house. Like it'll all be like, you know, the snake eating its own tail.
I think she's right.
I want those bottles.
I think you're right, Laura. I think there will be a market for these wines, especially now that he's like, you know, officially been convicted. And now he's kind of coming into his like, you know, I liken it to like the Anna Delveys of the world or, Gypsy Rose Blanchard, like these criminals who are now like celebrity status.
So he's going to be making wine, admittedly from.
So obviously.
I just wrote his business plan.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I guess like he's basically, you know, gone the route of some other politicians and is using his lawyer as his PR team. He's not going on the personally going there, but he's letting his lawyers say that, yeah, he is like producing wines in Asia for clients who want basically fakes. And I think, you know, it's sort of similar. We see this in the luxury sector with other things too, with like handbags. Mm-hmm. This is obviously super popular. And even at, you know, the upper echelon of things, right? Like it's well documented that even the most wealthy women who carry Birkins and Kellys and rare Louis Vuittons, even they have a mix of fake bags in their collection. And I can see a world in which this could kind of slide in that same genre and, you know, potentially be a collectible as well. Or I think you're spot on with that.
My argument would be back when he started doing this, I don't know, I got too deep the rabbit hole, but when he started doing this sort of things, there was no documentation. Nobody had really done that to that level, right? So people were full right and left. They were looking at labels and corks and all these things. They weren't doing that like with the microscope, with the magnifying glass, if you will. But now people are aware. So it's going to be harder for him to make a DRC, you name it, right? Pornso, whatever, wine, because now people are actually expecting it. So they're aware. They're like heightened alert.
Yeah, I agree with you. But I think, you know, there's, as Maureen Downey, who is now like the world's leading wine fraud expert, will tell you, like there's so few people who are truly specialized in finding fraudulent bottles. And really their only job to do that is going to be at auction. And that's not where these wines are going. They're being sold in the black market, just like any other fake bag or fake watch or whatever would be sold. And I think, you know, the people that are buying these wines know that they're buying fake wines and their intent isn't to get them authenticated. Their intent is to take them to a party and be like, look what I have. Like, isn't this so cool?
Because if you have a cellar, right, and you have one DRC from, you know, 1945, right, and you like Rudy, make me five more.
Yeah.
Like, I want to be able to bring out a case of them.
Yeah.
You know, like, I get it.
Yeah. If you went over someone's house. No, if you went over someone's house that had enough money and they showed you, you know, rare wines that they had amidst a collection of other things, right? If they were like, here's my Sutter home and a bottle of DRC, you might be like, perhaps not. But, you know, we've all been in these houses where, like, people have these crazy collections. Would you think for a second that they'd have, like, fakes in there? Like, I wouldn't. I'm here for the Netflix series. I need all of the Instagram, all of the Netflix, all the things that, like, these celebrity criminals are doing. Like, I need all of this for Rudy. So,
yes.
If you're listening, I don't support what you're doing, but I am watching. And speaking of supporting, if you guys want to support this podcast, you can do so by making sure that you're subscribed and leaving us a review, preferably the 5-star kind. If you have feedback, we're always open to it, but, you know, privately would be nice. And then the other thing you can do is come and drink with us. Support us in drinking along with the Wine Access Unfiltered Podcast Wine Club. We've got 4 wines for you every 2 months. I pick them with these guys right here. We have a lovely conversation going round the clock all the time looking for great wines for you guys. And that's what gets selected. So every wine, as you know, goes with an episode of the show. We also do tasting notes with them so you can really dive deep. And as we get into the next chapter of this podcast, you are going to be diving into the box that you hopefully already have to grab the Balboa Myth. This is a beautiful red blend coming from the Walla Walla Valley. And we'll be drinking that when we come back in just a second. All right, you guys, you have some wine?
Yes. And being in a hotel, I had to just kind of do away with my hotel opener.
Oh, no. How bad is the glassware? Let's see it for the YouTube. Oh, yeah. What do you got?
I actually managed to secure a semi. It's not my Gigi glass, but it works.
It's not bad.
It could be worse. It's not bad,
yeah. Laura and I are rocking our Gabriel glass.
Yeah.
Cheers to that. We get to cheers.
Eduardo, you should never leave home without your
I know. Jonah would be so disappointed.
I know, but I've broken so many already. The hard way. Let it break easy, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, let's see how I do with this, baby. And
hey!
Excellent work.
That's a good noise.
There we go.
All right, if you guys are drinking with us, you should have the Balboa Myth. As I mentioned, this is coming from Walla Walla, Washington, which we will talk about in just a second because the Walla Walla AVA is actually not just in Washington. It does straddle 2 states, both Oregon and Washington. And though the back of this wine does say Washington, the majority, the entirety of the fruit in this bottle is actually coming from the Oregon side of the Walla Walla Valley. So this is actually a wine made by Tom Glace, who is a legend in Walla Walla. He's been making wine there for like 25 years. He worked at Leocole No. 41, but this is his own winery that he started in 99. And the fruit for this wine is coming from 2 sources. One is the Eidolon Vineyard, which was actually bought by Drew Bledsoe in 2018. If you guys remember, we did a fantastic
full circle.
Yep. Fantastic episode with Drew about a year ago where he like schooled us on all things Washington and geology. And we were all kind of just sitting there like, wow, this guy, in addition to being like an amazing football player and a vintner, also like knows a shit ton about science. So here we are. Anyway, so he owns this vineyard. It's 18 acres. It's massive. When you get there, there's just like massive cobblestones that would remind you of something like Chateauneuf du Pape. And this is in the Rocks District, located within the Walla Walla AVA on the Oregon side. The other place that this is coming from is the Summit View Vineyard. This is just outside the boundary of the Rocks District, but it's also one of the highest altitude vineyards. This actually sits at about 1,200 feet, so that's pretty high. And like I said, on the Oregon side. And this is a blend. This is their top wine that they make. It's a blend of 72% Cabernet Sauvignon, 16% Cabernet Franc, and 12% Merlot. And one of the most important facts of all of this is that if you look at the vintage, this has a little age on it. It's a 2015. She's almost 10 years old.
You would not know from tasting it. This is so youthful.
Yeah.
Incredible.
This is beautiful. Who found this wine? Do you remember?
Chris, actually, part of our team. So yeah, we have the tasting panel and we have a team, which is Laura, Sir, me, and then Chris every once in a while like dabs in and finds some great gems from his relationships. Yeah. And yeah, this wine definitely rocked the world.
No pun intended.
We love it. I mean, the myth, the name, it's definitely proper for this wine.
No, it's really good. It's super juicy. But I think what I love about wines from this particular area is that they, for me, similar to the way that Oregon has always sort of straddled the line between California and Burgundy, I think Washington and Walla Walla wines from this area sort of straddle the line between California and Bordeaux. Like, there is something very Bordelais about this wine, even though it's juicy and it's rich and, you know, there's definitely some like some ripeness to this wine. It has that sort of like gravelly, graphite-y thing kind of on the bottom there that you really don't see very much coming out of California. And structurally, this wine is a totally different beast. You know, I think it, you know, though it's very big, it's also, you know, it's, it feels very grounded at the same time.
There's an excellent tension to it. There's a little cocoa, there's herb, there's all these things, but it is a very well put together. It's a symphony of a wine. It's not one-sided. It's not like primal. It's not just fruit. It is all together. It's like the whole football team coming at you at the same time.
Right.
There's no treble or bass or anything coming up but on its own. I am quite excited and thrilled of how delicious it's drinking right now, especially.
Well, and I'm sure you're extra excited being the representative from US who gets to include this wine in here.
Absolutely. I have to raise the flag high.
I am getting a little nervous over here for France. No, it's really, it's really elegant. And there's definitely an old world quality to this as it's kind of aging and opening up. It has that like leather bound book, you know, with a little dust on it, kind of that, like that kind of smell, a little bit of sandalwood, which is really, it's really pretty, but then there's that core of that fruit and you're really, the fruit is pristine and ripe, but it's kind of sitting in the back a little bit.
Totally.
And the texture is lovely. I mean, it's still got grip and tannin, but it's very, very smooth.
I almost wonder if this wine like scared people in its youth. You know, a wine with this much age, like
just
that
came out just too
big. Yeah, like, you know, this wine has like serious structure. And as you said, like it feels so fresh that I just wonder, you know, when wines are drinking this way, even at that 9, 10, 11 year mark, like, you know, I to me, if I had to back up a little bit, I have to wonder if like when this wine came out, they were like, we can't sell this wine right now. Like it's not, you know, almost the way that Bordeaux like needs time. Like this wine is not ready to drink. And this is coming right from the winery. So it's not like it's been, you know, hanging around somewhere.
Yeah, this is a decision. I think when the winery has the luxury of holding back, like in this case, we were able to secure an allocation of 2015. Think about it. The economics that goes on holding that wine back. Clearly, it's just the more it sits there, the more money you're just holding into it, right? And that's, to me, it's one of the most fascinating things when you're able to secure those wines that are completely ready. Because to your point, maybe in 2017, 18, when this wine started to be available or could have been available, the consumer would have been, I mean, or maybe even the winery, maybe Tom is the one that made the decision, said, this is not ready. I'm not going to go out there with something representing me. And that's pretty cool.
I think that's probably exactly what happened, but this wine is really starting to come around in a really beautiful way. And I actually wouldn't mind grabbing. This is actually a very reasonably priced wine too. I think it's like $30 on Wine Access right now.
It's crazy. And it's really just hitting that second gear, third gear, where it's just starting to get momentum. Like this has, you know, five years of time where it's still going to evolve and still going to be this like really powerful expression. So I feel like, this would be a wine to drink with us and then stock up on, because what a shocker to be able to bring this out in 5 years.
So the way that this is going to work is I'm going to pit the benchmark regions. You can kind of consider these like the top seeded teams, right? And I think also we always assume wrongly that the benchmark region is the greatest, but that's not necessarily the case. The only reason I'm doing that is because this is sort of the region that we measure up to, that other winemakers have looked at as saying, okay, they've been doing it longer. This is kind of what we want to emulate, but you know, it doesn't mean that they haven't been surpassed. So we're going to work through the pros and cons of each to sort of make a final call. Given that we have a Bordeaux blend in our glass, I thought we would begin there with Bordeaux. And just a reminder, I mean, the point of all of this is to arm you guys with the savviest of knowledge to know when to choose and why. And like, I can sit here and I can explain soil types and the grapes, which is all important, which we've talked about in other episodes. But understanding where these wines fit in the world is sort of like figuring out what movie to watch on a Tuesday, right? Who are you with? What's the mood? How tired are you? Do you want to think about it? Do you not want to think about it? And so those are all factors that I think we're considering, obviously economics as well, when we are deciding between regions. So to start, we've got Bordeaux, and it's Bordeaux versus California, which of course includes Napa and Paso, Australia, Washington, Argentina, Chile, the Florida Atlantic. And I am including Tuscany in here. That's a weird one to include, but I am going to include it
I think it's perfect.
Okay. So Bordeaux, obviously pros. They've been doing it for a long time. They've been producing wines since around 4380. So a little bit of experience and history on their side. It's the home of the first growth. So you've got Lafite, Latour, Margaux, Aubryon, et cetera, which we could argue for or against. And then cons would be inconsistent vintages. You know, a bad vintage in Bordeaux is usually pretty bad. And
price.
Price. Though not always. You know, we've seen.
Yeah, the big names, right? Which is tough. Yeah. Because Bordeaux, like, it can almost be like Bordeaux versus Bordeaux in a way. Like there is a subsection of Bordeaux that is not that, you know, super expensive, super hard to come by, rarefied air wines. But I think as a region, yes, they're definitely represented by the top players.
Right. So when are we choosing Bordeaux? What are some of the things that are factoring into the decision when we're like, tonight is Bordeaux night?
I gravitate towards Bordeaux when I want to find something with age that I want to feel confident about.
Mm.
Like if I'm like, you know what, I want to buy a bottle of wine that is a specific vintage for an occasion, a birth year, an anniversary or something where I know it's a good vintage in Bordeaux, it's like that. And if I go and I get a kind of reputable producer in a good year, I am fairly confident that the wine's going to deliver. Like it's a region that has so much history and so much experience making long-lived wines.
Yeah.
That like, I feel like I can count on that as a region. If you were like, oh, find me the best bottle from, you know, the 90s, like all of our birth years, right?
Yes. That's a good point. I don't think I had considered that, but you're right. When people ask me I want to buy something that's from a birth year, it's usually Bordeaux that we go to first. We look, to your point, we look for a good producer. It doesn't have to be a first growth. It can be a second growth, a third growth, even just, you know, well-known producer. And then a good vintage is key. And I think going back to what I said before, Bordeaux is one of those places that if you hit it in a bad vintage, it's not good. Like they don't do bad vintages particularly well. And to me, that's where other places like California kind of usurp Bordeaux in that way. So if we're pitting Bordeaux against California, where does California stack up against Bordeaux? And what would be some reasons to choose California?
So Bordeaux, it's a great indicator. It's been doing it forever. It's a great teacher. But I feel like California, specifically, as we know, the Napa Valley, has surpassed the teacher. And a wealth of geology and climate, together with great expertise on how to make the wines, tannin management, all those different things, when to pick, all these things, and also gifted with great vintages almost back-to-back on a general year. I think that just surpasses that.
I think when we're talking about Napa in particular, I think what Napa has that Bordeaux does not and will not ever have, and what makes Napa so interesting are the mountains.
Mm, true.
Is the distinct mountains, right? Like there is a quality, and I think the producers and some of which you've mentioned, like that really do their wines speak to the place that they were made, and they're made on these mountains that have their own distinct microclimate and soil.
I agree. I think Napa has a lot more when it comes to terroir diversity. I think there's definitely terroir diversity in Bordeaux, but you're dealing more with style of houses more so than actual terroir, right? Like you're really splitting hairs there between Lafite and Latour, for example. I think where it gets in, like, I think there's no question that like at the upper echelon, Napa and Bordeaux can go toe to toe and you really can't lose because price-wise, they're pretty comparable, as Eduardo mentioned. Quality-wise, you know, both at the top of their game for sure. I don't think that I could venture to say which one is necessarily better. I think where it gets interesting is in that tier below that. So in that like middle to like lower tier, Where I think there is more consistency, you might pay more of a premium for Napa wines, but I think there's more consistency in that middle to lower tier than Bordeaux has. Because as we said, there's inconsistency with vintages. And then you also, like, you're very producer dependent. There's Napa's a lot smaller than Bordeaux. And I think that when you're talking about that, there's not a ton of wines in Napa for like $30 to $150. But if you are comparing apples to apples, I do think that's where like Napa does outshine Bordeaux personally. But, and here's where it gets interesting, right? If we're talking about, and this is why this March Madness thing is so fun, because, you know, price has to be a factor in this conversation in order for this to work, right? In order for you to go into a store, like you're thinking about how much you're going to spend. Where it gets interesting is when you throw places like Washington, where I'm going to say Washington and includes Walla Walla, because to me, that's just more Washington. When you throw something like Washington into the mix in that $30 to $100 category, I think that's where Washington kicks everyone's ass.
True story. Overall, yeah.
The price of land is less and has been, and there's some great growing regions in Washington and some great expertise that have gone up there. And yeah, no, I agree. And then you start about Margaret River in the same way.
Oh yeah, Australia. We cannot forget Australia. Yeah, you're right. Mm-hmm. Margaret River. What's the wine that Andrew is loving? The McHenry O'Honan, right? That we've included in a few different things.
Yes, indeed.
We have those, and like Lewin Estate, yeah. You know, makes world class Cabernet, and it's $50. It's a song.
Yeah, I think in that $50 camp, I am with you. I'm Australia. I'm Washington. We cannot not talk about Argentina, which is obviously more Malbec heavy, but there's a ton of Cabernet Franc and a ton of Cabernet Sauvignon. Malbec is still a Bordeaux varietal, so it still counts.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I think we cannot discount Argentina, especially when you're talking about producers like Zuccardi that are in the Uco Valley.
Absolutely.
That are, you know, making wines from high elevation vineyards, doing them in a completely unique style and charging like nothing for them.
I think we touched on this earlier, but I think the one region that if you like Napa or you like Bordeaux, or you're looking for a rival that I think is like right there is Bulgari.
Oh, uh-huh. Okay.
I think,
she threw it in.
They're personally like I love Sassicaia. I love it when it's aged. I love it when it's fresh. I think that combination of sun and soil and exposure on Bordeaux varieties is something magical that toes the line of Bordeaux in a way, but it's still so unique. They're still uniquely Italian.
Mm-hmm. I got to work the harvest in Bulgari at Sapaio a couple seasons ago, and it's insane the similarities being there as harvest is happening. Well, I didn't work harvest. I documented for a few days.
Of course.
So I didn't get too tired. But seeing the landscape, seeing everything, the quality of the fruit, all that, it's very similar to Napa in that point. But yeah, as you mentioned, the soil, like it's, and they produce amazing wines. And there's ranges too.
Okay.
And they've taken influence from Bordeaux. They've taken influence, you know, Andrei Chelichev went on there to help, you know, guide Musetto. And so they've taken influence from both of these places. And they make wines that are unbelievably, like, well-priced.
Yeah, I would agree.
There's always the top dogs, but there's $50, $40 bottles of red wine from Tuscany.
But even Sassicaia is, like, not crazy. I mean, it's not cheap, but it's not crazy, right? It's, like, what, $300 or something?
It would be a second tier in Napa.
Yeah. Like, I mean, mm-hmm. Listen, $300 is not nothing. But when we're talking about these wines that are coming out of Napa and Bordeaux and starting at $800 out of the gate, you know, $300 is like a steal, right?
I would also make an argument for Spain and Rioja in that it has the Bordeaux influenced it so much, you know, in their winemaking and using oak. I mean, it's so distinct using Tempranillo and different grapes, but it does have that connection in a way. If you're looking for a vintage birth year and Bordeaux is not available, Rioja is a great place
to go. Yes, very true.
Or Champagne or port.
Yes. Well, speaking of Champagne, we're going to switch gears. I'll let us kind of like decide on if there's a clear winner on the Bordeaux versus the world category, but Champagne versus the world.
Oh,
this is a tough one to do for a lot of reasons. Obviously sparkling wine can be made in a few different ways. Champagne, the OG, some would argue, I love champagne. I will die on the Champagne Hill, even though it's Laura's region. I'll still give it to you. Like, champagne is better than sparkling wine from any other region, and that includes Spain. But I do think that there are some incredible other regions that are doing a fantastic job, namely Oregon, California, Tasmania. I'm saying specifically Tasmania, not Australia. Italy, the rest of France, and Spain.
Argentina also makes amazing.
Argentina's making good sparkling. I'm not throwing them in this parade, though.
No. And not a lot of it makes it out of there anyway. I mean, for that point, Brazil also does, but that's not in the conversation.
England.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I did forget the UK.
Yeah. The UK makes amazing stuff. Unlike Bordeaux, I feel like champagne is untouchable. Nobody can make it like that.
Look at Laura's
smug
face.
And there are some amazing examples. Nobody does champagne because you have the right conditions.
Bring me my crystal. Champagne is unrivaled. There's no question. It is not just a place and a wine. It is an idea that lives in all of us. but I think there's other great values in sparkling wine. I mean, Franciacorta used to be a great value. Now those are kind of creeping up in price.
Yeah, but Trentadoc.
There are some great producers.
Like the Ferrari wines from
Trento, Altalaga. Yeah.
Right. Northern Italy is a great place to find some beautiful bubbles. And they do use, and besides Prosecco, they use the champagne method. They use the traditional method. I always find that cava can be, if you're the right producer, and you know, you mm-hmm. spend a little bit more than your base level cava because they have to be made in the traditional method. They can have a ton of character for a fraction of the price. Mm-hmm.
I think cava is great, but because of the composition of varietals that they're utilizing, it will never match champagne. And I know you've tried to prove me wrong when you were running the Spanish restaurant.
No, I don't think it's trying to.
Oh my God, try this.
I don't think it's trying to beat champagne, but I think it speaks its own language.
It does
and
produce
tells
great
its own
stuff at that
beautifully.
Level.
Yeah.
Franciacorta in the last 5 years, because I have a few friends that make Franciacorta and I spend a lot of time in that area, they have now looked into champagne and brought people like Richard Geoffroy, who was the chef de cave at Dom Perignon for years, for guidance. And there's people like that are coming in and consulting and they're trying to find it. I love what they're doing at Franciacorta, but guys, you're never going to be champagne, right? Champagne's the king.
I think similar to what we did with Bordeaux, we have to sort of tier out not only price, but why we're drinking this, right? Because there's a lot of different reasons you would, like, there's only really one reason you're drinking, like, Bordeaux. Like, you're probably having dinner or you're visiting one of the regions, right? Champagne is, like, one of the beverages that can be consumed at all times of day without judgment. Mm-hmm. I won't judge you for drinking Bordeaux in the morning, but someone might. And champagne or sparkling wine is kind of one of those rarities where you can kind of drink it breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And so for that reason, champagne, I think there are situations where though it may be the best and though it may be unrivaled, it is maybe not always the best choice. So when you're talking about like it kills me when people do like mimosas with champagne. Yeah. Like,
Okay. Why?
That's why you have cava and prosecco.
Exactly. And I think those are the moments where it's like, get your $15 to $20 cava or Franciacorta. Like, there's some great ones that Wine and some of the Cremants as well that Wine Access has, like that Henri Champliot is wonderful. It's like the Cremant of Bourgogne, I think, is wonderful.
And we have Cremant de Loire can be really, really nice with, you know, early in the day or with our, you know. And also, like, if you just want to get like a magnum of something and savor it.
Yes.
It doesn't have to be champagne. Just for that kind of like celebratory act, you can get magnums of anything.
Yeah. I think when you're drinking sparkling wine on its own and you want to enjoy it, like you want that the taste of it, like champagne, great. Enjoy all day long. Mm-hmm. I do think there's situations for some people because champagne, obviously, there's a whole champagne episode you should go listen to. It's great. But we talk about, you know, the fact that it's very cold there. It's therefore the grapes are very high in acid. And so for some people, and champagne and sparkling wine are always going to be high acid wines. But if you go to warmer regions and to get sparkling wine, you might find that you prefer it, namely from California, because the acid levels are going to be a little bit lower and the fruit profile is going to be a little bit stronger. And so it's going to feel a little fruitier and a little bouncier, a little bit more like for someone like my mom, for example. My mom cannot do champagne, but she loves sparkling wine from warmer regions because it doesn't feel so acidic and, you know, zesty for her. So I think that's a situation in which California does. I will say, I think if there were two regions that could compete with champagne, it would be Tasmania and Oregon in like a real way. And I don't know how much Oregon sparkling we've had.
Argyle, we're about to offer it. It's outstanding.
Argyle is fantastic.
Oh, mama.
Yeah.
Great value too.
One of my favorites, the Grand Marine Blanc de Blanc. It's a vintage Blanc de Blanc. It's still expensive. It's $100 a bottle. And I think that's where you're like, would I still get that over champagne? I don't know. But that to me is like one of the best examples of sparkling wine that is as close to champagne as you can get outside of the region. Well, we love champagne. There's plenty of it on the Wine Access website. Yeah. I know this because I buy it a lot. Yeah.
Me too.
But if you're looking for other things, please do look at Oregon, California. Do not ignore Tasmania. House of Aris, Jans, Clover Hill. They're all wonderful producers. In Italy, Prosecco, which is made in a whole different way and a whole different category of sparkling wine. And it's lovely, but it is not champagne. And I want to be clear about that. Prosecco is its own thing. Frontacorta, Trenta Doc, and I mentioned Ferrari, a wonderful producer. Those wines start at like $25. And
yes,
they're a really great deal.
I do got to make a side note. If you are going to somebody's party and it's more than eight people, there's nothing better than showing up with a magnum of champagne. If it's more people,
you're invited, Eduardo, and there's 10 people coming.
Yep.
My house, the cellar is filled with those. Well, not filled. We've been depleting a lot, but
we wish.
I cannot show up anywhere unless it's a 1.8 liter of sake or a magnum of champagne so everybody can taste it. And if they like it, have more.
Ugh.
That's I dropped the mic right there.
Ever the guest, ever the humble guest. I love it. We are going to touch on Italy, but before we get there, we have to talk about Burgundy. I think this will be probably the most fascinating. Yeah, we all kind of sat back in our seats and like gulped. Burgundy, land of Pinot, land of Chardonnay. We can throw Beaujolais in there if we want, but why? It's his own thing. Burgundy versus Oregon, California, Tasmania. And I am including just for you, Eduardo, Patagonia / Argentina.
All right.
I know you're a champion of the South and Southern Americas.
Yes, indeed. It's a tough one. I'm just going to say this. There are generalizations, but I think if we are talking about comparison, it's got to be more about producer specific.
Yes.
And my point is like you're looking at Walter Scott in Oregon. You're looking at, you can name a few, but you cannot talk about a whole area because California, for instance, again, we have that climate. It produces richer, bolder styles, a little more generous. And that's what the customer has been asking for.
When are you choosing Burgundy? Let's start there.
If I know that I'm going to get a full glass of it.
Okay.
I love Burgundy. And Burgundy is this, it's like a never-ending quest on discovery in such a small region through the lens of two grapes. I drink Burgundy every chance I get because I feel like you never know it enough and you have to experience
it. It's also Russian roulette. So, you know,
and the only way to like figure it out is to be tasting a lot of it and drinking a lot of it, which is hard. And so yes, never turn down Burgundy, but I do love like, let's talk about the US. I love the range through those two grapes, the range of wines that could be produced. Like, you can do Chardonnay that is lean and mean and just and aged in stainless, and it's got like the super like laser acidity to it. And then you can do these richer, fuller styles. You can produce all of that in the United States. And so you can show like just a range of styles and climates through one grape. Same with Pinot Noir. So I feel like the variety you have to play with in the New World with these grapes is interesting. But the focus in Burgundy is, you know, what you get in that small area is unbelievable.
I love Burgundy, but I feel like it's a toxic boyfriend. And I want to make the relationship work. I want it to, because we had great moments and I remember them well. No. There have been so many bad ones and I'm like, ugh, like I don't, it hurts every time. And you, like, you guys know it, like you're rolling your eyes, you know what I'm talking about. And like the thing with Burgundy is like, it's so producer specific. It's so vintage specific. And it's also like, it's so fickle. Like it really depends on the day that you open it, whether it's going to be good or not. And to me, like as a consumer, I could not buy a bottle of Burgundy without either one, knowing that it's going to be a gamble, or two, being so secure in my purchase that I know I can't lose. And that's not really a possible thing to have in with Burgundy. And so for that reason,
to me, that's PYCM.
What's that?
I can always do PYCM. I buy every PYCM. I've never been fooled.
I have a whole cellar full of it, just hoping that it's going to be great. Because it is, that's a very consistent producer. But, you know.
But there's still risk,
there's
right?
So, yeah. And there's so much bad Burgundy. We actually had this conversation on an earlier podcast, and Lex Nicoletta likened it to like ordering Chipotle. She was like, you just never know if it's going to be a good day at Chipotle.
Oh my God.
And it's so true. Because I was like, you know, Burgundy, like sometimes it's good and sometimes. And for that reason, like, you know, Burgundy is the benchmark. It's the goat. It's wonderful. Everyone should experience Burgundy and everyone should be so lucky to have a bank account large enough that they can substantiate these massive purchases that are necessary to really enjoy Burgundy. But most of us are not there. And so for that reason, to me, these other regions are where I'm looking when it comes to Pinot and Chardonnay.
I think it's very fair. And I think if you find a producer and a style in the New World that you like, you know, because I think just as Burgundy is fickle, like just the grape, like Pinot Noir itself is fickle. So if you find one you like and you like their style in California, in the New World in general, they're going to be so consistent that like, there's nothing wrong with sticking to that and kind of finding things that are similar to it.
Without going too far or going too far, and Patagonia, there's, as you mentioned, Chacra, Bodegas Chacra. That is an always deliver. Yeah. We just had recently
we just had a Chard.
And
so good.
Money.
So good.
They've done a fantastic job with what they have.
And I like, you know, some of the, like I like Santa Rita Hills
as a
region for Pinot Noir. And it's so distinctly not Burgundy. And it just got this like, it's got this power.
Like seaweedy, but it's still, umami. You know,
it's still like super, it's one of the longest growing seasons for Pinot Noir in the world. And it has so much complexity and it's so unique. And I love those wines. I love that region. If I'm looking for like a New World Pinot. And I actually like New Zealand Pinot.
Oh yeah, I forgot about our Kiwis. I'm sorry.
Can be kind of fun. It's super clean. It can be fresh. You know, really kind of like lighter. I like those wines. So I think there's like a place and time for all of them.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's also the beauty of those two particular grapes, right? Pinot can really, as long as it's grown in a good place, like it can really show its terroir probably better than any of the other grapes that we've talked about thus far, although I guess champagne is technically Pinot and Chard. But
what would be what's the funniest thing is that the most uniquely Burgundian thing, I guess, would be the Beaujolais then.
Oh, that is so true.
It actually does not travel.
It doesn't travel. No, which I think is true.
As a grape, as a style of a wine, like is like that's it. Like if you want Gamay made it in its best, you're only going to one place in the world.
No, that's fair. I want to.
Like Nebbiolo doesn't travel.
Well, this is where I'm getting right now is Italy. I saved it for last, and you can fight me on this. We're all friends here. It's fine. I saved it for last because I'm not sure it has any competitors. I'm not sure that it has equivalence in the way that these other regions do. And so I'm not giving it to Sir. I refuse to give it to Sir, but.
Or at least let's make them work for it. I mean,
yeah, but
there are love letters to Italy throughout the world. There are great.
Anyone can write a love letter, Eduardo.
In Mexico. Oh, absolutely. I'm just putting that on the side. Nobody compares because nobody has the Italian charm, the soils, the way things are done so specifically regional to each area, how one place in Umbria does things so different than Montalcino and vice versa and all these different things. You cannot replicate that. I mean, I'm sorry to bring this back all the way to Japan, but Japan would be to me the only country that it's so regional that you cannot replicate things specifically. So sorry, I had to do that. But yeah, Italy just has, there's no way. Nobody does any other grapes better. Yeah.
I think you can make an argument that Spain is also its own self-contained thing.
Agreed.
That not that, that you know, like no one does what Spain does like Spain. Like yes. Tempranillo and with Grenache, where it is regional, and Cava, like they have, and sherry.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Spain also is unique in the world the way that Italy is.
And when you think about the way that the culture has identified with the wine and how that's influenced the food, like those two regions more so than, because France is so stylized, like Italy and Spain, like it really is so cultural, and that's been, everything is tied together. That when you kind of separate those elements out, they're just not the same. Like Tempranillo outside of Spain mm-hmm. is not the same. Nebbiolo outside of Italy, outside of Piedmont, not the same. And I think it's because, you know, as you kind of pointed out, like there is something culturally about these places where like everything just works together so harmoniously that when you see them outside, it's just like, it just doesn't really translate. If I'm eating Italian food, there is absolutely zero chance I'm drinking anything other than Italian wine.
Or sake.
Wow.
Sake. I'm not drinking sake. I'm sorry. I'll drink it with French fries and the Moroccan. No one is having lasagna and sake. It's not happening. Prove me wrong.
You haven't lived yet. You haven't lived. No, but you could say that for like a cotterone. You could get a $20 cotterone and have an amazing lasagna with it.
But it's that 2 + 2 = 100, you know, where you get with Italian wine and the Italian food. I think you're right. Like it can kind of, the sum of the parts are greater, but
I do think the flip side of that is true as well. And this is sort of a, I don't know if it's a pro or a con for Italy with Italian wine. There's very few Italian wines that you want to drink without food, like not a ton that are yes. delicious on their own. Like they're almost right. universally better with you something to together, snack on. Yeah. So
right.
For some people, that's a good thing. For some people, like that's annoying.
If you're looking for the value for white wine, one of the best places to go is Italy. There's just a range True. And a range of prices, a range of styles. And if you find, you know, yeah, if you find the region with the cuisine you're kind of looking for, you know, whether it's seafood or heavier stuff, you just find the wine that's grown there.
I'm choosing Italian whites over Bordeaux whites pretty much 100% of the time. Maybe not Loire Valley whites. That would be kind of like neck mm-hmm. and neck. But it would go between the two. Like if I want like a crispy white, I'm either going to have an Italian white or a Loire Valley white.
My only argument with that, and I hate to be in that hole, but the Loire has become such a name, right? Starting by Sancerre.
Yeah.
Everybody knows Sancerre, even if they don't know that's a Sauvignon Blanc, mm-hmm. right? They'll see it on a list. They order it. Doesn't matter the price these days. But because of that, because of that attention and the great marketing skills, there's been a lot of producers and overproduced. So sometimes you might find the crappy wine in there.
Totally.
That was just done in there, right? But Italy, who in the hell, except for our good friend Dan Petruschi and Masakan, who is making a Greco? Who's making a Falanghina? Who's True. Making a Tocca e Friulano? All these things. So the quality is there. This is like multi-generational producers. And normally from these soils, nobody's coming in and like, oh my God, everybody's talking about this Friulano.
I would just say be careful with your Pinot Grigio.
Yes.
Pinot Grigio, it's the exception.
Pinot Grigio is that the is exception. Market.
Yeah, it's a name.
Don't spend more than $20 in Pinot. Try not to spend more than like $15 on Pinot Grigio, but definitely don't spend more than like $20, $25. It's not a...
Yeah.
Yeah. That is the
yeah, because right that's become a commodity. But yeah, there other than that, and yeah, if they're just, we honestly in Wine Access, it's one of our largest categories because we all love them.
Yeah,
because like we all, you know, like I think any other wine shop would be like, yeah, I think you just need, you know, one from the north, one from the south, and we just love those wines so much.
Yeah,
and we drink them so much that we have like, we'll have like 14 different Italian white wines
because they're so good
on the site at one time because we feel they're all different.
To the diversity.
There's a time and place for all of yeah. them. It's.
I was going to mention, don't drink Pinot Grigio. If you're at a wedding and your choices are like Pinot Grigio and Chardonnay, I actually go Pinot Grigio over Chardonnay because it's like, it's usually cheaper to make and yeah. it's harder to F up. But along the same lines.
One ice cube.
Exactly. Yeah. Get club soda, lemons, whatever you got to do. if you are planning events, i.e. weddings, parties, whatever, Italian white wines all day long. Italian wines in general, but Italian white wines especially, they tend to be slightly lower alcohol. They're crispy. They're delicious. They're like universally appealing. And like a lot of times they'll have something like really fun going on and someone would be like, what is that? That's, I didn't expect that. This wine was delicious. This conversation was so much fun. Thank you. I hope everyone listening enjoyed it. But sure, even if you didn't, I had a really good time. I feel like I don't get to like banter about wine.
This is delicious. Oh, yeah. Thank you so much.
Oh, Laura, I love that you got to refill your glass on this show.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm in California time, so it is all good for me.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. End of the day. And I'm sure you have to get back to judging some more hybrid varietals from Montana or something, right, Eduardo?
Hopefully, hopefully more fun stuff. But yeah, sake is in the horizon.
Well, thanks for doing the Lord's work for us, Eduardo, and finding all the good things. For everyone listening, thank you so much. If you are not a member of the Wine Access Unfiltered Podcast Wine Club, now's your cue. Everything's down in the description. Get in on it. We've got a new shipment coming up soon. Our next episode is also on Chardonnay, and I'm very excited about that because we just waxed poetic about Oregon Chardonnay, and that is what's featured in the next episode. So you have that to look forward to. And if you are not subscribed to this podcast either on YouTube, where you might be watching our faces, or wherever you get your podcast, please take a moment to do that. And like I said, leave us a 5-star review. That's so helpful. All right, you guys, thank you so much. I appreciate y'all being here. And we don't have a winner, but if you want to follow what's going on Instagram to see who the socials decide is the winner, then you should absolutely do that.
It'll be a little heated.
It could get heated. Yes. It's going to be fun. We've got a lot of like surprises in store. So definitely follow us there. All right, you guys. Cheers. Thank you.
Cheers.
Cheers. Thank you.